You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. I promise this will be the last day I do the show from home. We could not get an ISDN line in here fast enough. It just wasn't possible. And anyhow, all that stuff. So my apologies for the audio quality. The feedback we've been getting from our listeners is that as wonderful as our fill-in hosts were, they'd rather have me coming in on a telephone line than a fill-in host. Although we will tomorrow have a fill-in host because I've got to go to the hospital and finally get all these damn tubes taken out of me that shouldn't be there if the surgery had not screwed up somehow. We'll leave it at that. But anyhow, tomorrow's hopefully the end of this nightmare that was supposed to be just a little, you know, 1 day surgery and 4 days recovery. And on we go. Enough complaining about all that. But Senator Bernie Sanders, because tomorrow I'm going to have a fill-in host, Senator Sanders is going to be with us the third hour of our program today. We're going to do Brunch with Bernie in our third hour. So get your questions ready for America's Senator. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here at 3 o'clock. There's a fascinating piece over in Salon Magazine that I thought so brilliantly exemplifies the difference between conservative and traditional American philosophies. I'm not even going to say liberal. I mean, you know, traditional American philosophies. I remember last year, maybe a year and a half ago or so, a couple of years ago, we did our show for a week from Anchorage. The IBEW invited me to come up and keynote their address, and we did our show from our Anchorage affiliate. And a friend of ours, who at the time was, one of the county planning people in Portland, by coincidence showed up, we had dinner together. And David was making the comment, you know, that Anchorage has to be one of the most clumsily planned cities ever. I mean, there's no place for pedestrians. It's sprawl everywhere. It doesn't work. Well, Tampa, where the Republicans are having their convention, is pretty much in the same boat. And this illustrates the difference. And I've seen this. I mean, I've lived in cities where there was no planning. I've lived in cities where there was some planning. And I've lived in Portland, Oregon, which is probably one of the most planned cities, well-regulated cities in the United States. And what you find is that in cities where there's no planning and they try to do it, the Ayn Rand, Friedrich von Mises, Friedrich Hayek, fill in the blank. The Paul Ryan Reaganomics, no regulation path. Oh yeah, just build something. You got the money, go ahead and build it. Yeah, shopping center over there, that's fine. Oh, you want to put 500 homes over there and no facilities, no stores, nothing near them. That's okay. People will drive. You know, we got cars, we got oil, we can take all we want from Saudi Arabia, and if they don't want to sell it to us, we'll bomb Iraq. You know, it's not a problem. That's the story of Tampa. And as Will Doig is writing for Salon, he says, poke around the White House website and you'll still find the hopeful fact sheet for a 324-mile high-speed rail line linking Miami, Orlando, and Tampa. No such system exists, of course. It was killed by Florida Governor Rick Scott. And today there's a 40-acre vacant terminal or vacant lot where the Tampa terminal would have stood. Isn't this brilliant? Now, of course, Scott did this in large part because the Republicans have an absolute commitment to destroying the economy and thus destroying the Obama presidency. It's very straightforward. This is not rocket science. To say that Republicans don't believe in building infrastructure, out loud, yeah, they don't believe in building infrastructure. The Koch brothers certainly don't. They got their own private jets and private planes and chauffeurs, and they don't have to worry about this stuff. And the same with much of the top 100th of 1% of America. Although, as we've noted, there are some very, very good people in that group as well. But the point is that infrastructure by the Republicans or by the laissez-faire Republicans, by the business bunch, is viewed not as the soil in which you can grow a business, not as the soil in which you can build a community. You can build good schools. You can build a sense of belonging. You can, you know, build hospitals and build factories and businesses, and people get to know each other, and people, you know, want to raise their kids there and all that. They don't see it that way. So-called conservatives, now, you know, Barry Goldwater saw it that way. Dwight Eisenhower saw it that way. Back in the day, even Richard Nixon saw it that way. But ever since Reagan, they've looked at these things like urban planning and, you know, making cities work. In Portland, we had this wonderful thing, mixed-use housing, where, you know, if you're going to build an apartment building, you had the first floor had to be offices. Everybody had to be within a less than a half-mile walk of a grocery store. I mean, they, lots of regulations. And the consequence of those regulations was that everybody wanted to live in Portland. Every, you know, downtown just went through this and still is doing it. You know, went through this incredible renewal. And it's happening. It's happened in cities all across America, but not in Tampa. The headline, in fact, Tampa, one of America's most screwed up cities, is home to the GOP convention. And how appropriate is this? Because as Will Doig points out, you could fairly call this the GOP vision for the country, the Tampification of America. Let me just share some of the details on this. This is, you know, a lot of cities made these mistakes in the 80s and 90s. They just let the developers go wild. They, you know, like Alan Greenspan, you know, the Ayn Rand. If you just let people with the money make the decisions and let the free market do its will, which is really just a euphemism for let the people with the money make the decisions. But those decisions will always work out best for the people. Well, no, sorry. Those decisions work out best as short-term profits for developers. When you got 500 people living in a suburban subdivision community, and literally no sidewalks, and the only way they can get to a store, to a grocery store, is to drive 5 miles, you've got something that's really not sustainable, and it's not a high quality of life. So, a lot of cities around the country, like Dallas and Houston, for example, are fixing this stuff. I mean, they're actually going back and looking at urban planning. And here's a quote. This is from Steve Shawcraft in Will Doig's piece. He's the Tampa Bay Area's representative to the Congress of the New Urbanism. And he says, Tampa has been, we look at Dallas or Houston with all the same challenges we have. They've managed to start changing their patterns of development and attract the creative class younger folks who are looking for alternatives to the suburban lifestyle. I mean, you know, pretty straightforward stuff. Even Houston, Doig writes, like other Sunbelt cities, has been working to rectify its mistakes, constructing successful light rail lines and some lively mixed-use neighborhoods. Meanwhile, in 2010, voters in Tampa's Hillsborough County rejected a 1-cent sales tax that would have funded a new light rail system. A new light rail system. 1 cent. They turned it down. That same year, by the way, the Tampa Bay area saw the nation's largest increase in traffic congestion. This is what happens with this, no, don't tax me. No, don't take a penny. Literally, don't take a penny, because that's a bad thing. Building infrastructure, let somebody else build it. The Koch brothers will build the infrastructure, and they'll charge people to use it. And, you know, the rich people, they'll pay, and the poor people, to hell with them. You know, and that's this. Well, in fact, he refers to the Tea Party paranoia and includes a bizarre fear of smart growth policies. So sprawl is the Tampa Bay gospel, as the Salon article writes, 4.6 people per acre. Downtown Tampa, meanwhile, he writes, has a windswept, desolate feel outside of business hours. And so true it is. And they point out that the business owners are starting to freak out. Like, our city's falling apart. What are we doing about it? So anyway, the question in my mind, what sort of America would we have? And how much worse will it get if the Republicans continue this kind of insanity?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, Anything Goes Thursday as well. It's the summer. If there's anything that's on your mind you want to talk about, just give us a shout. 866-987-THLM. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here live. American idiots are having a convention in the path of a hurricane. and in one of the most poorly planned cities in America. This is an absolute libertarian paradise slash disaster. The business owners are starting to panic that the city will go to pot and it will start impacting the tourism industry. Behind the scene, business leaders have discussed the need to provide political cover for elected officials in working toward infrastructure investment, reported Tampa Bay Online. This, again, from this brilliant piece in Salon Magazine by Will Doig. And it's just, you know, it's like the Republicans are going to their Mecca. Meanwhile, the Pew study just came out. Average household income in the United States has dropped by about $3,000 over the last decade or so. And it's now, we're in a worse, it's about as bad as it was right after World War II. There was a period, there was a pretty severe recession there until the GI Bill kicked in, lasted a couple of years. And we're back there. Or maybe we're back with the, you know, on the edge of the Great Depression. And why? Well, because the Republicans won't spend the money. And last night I had a long conversation with Neil Barofsky, the guy who is the special investigator general for the Treasury Department on the TARP program. This is George Bush's TARP program, even though Barofsky is a Democrat. What he said was, he said, okay, we had the $700 million. There was a couple hundred million dollars allocated, or maybe it was $40 billion, excuse me, allocated to give to homeowners to pay down their principal. And he said, they just chose not to do it. And I said, you know, what's the deal? Why would anybody do that? You know, what's going on? And he said, he actually had, and he told me this story, and I can quote it here. This is the guy who was in charge of looking for waste and fraud in TARP, right? He was the inspector general in the Bush administration. The first, you know, Henry Paulson's trembling, you know, give the bank $700 billion deal. And he said that a colleague of his came to him and said, you should keep your mouth shut. I'm paraphrasing here, but words to this effect. You should keep your mouth shut because you're hurting your future opportunities. You're hurting, you know, if you just go along and get along and make sure that the banksters get all these billions and billions of dollars and screw the average consumer, you will have such a future. You know, you'll be the VP of a bank making a million bucks a year. I mean, there's all kinds of potential that can come out of this. Just keep your head down and shut up. And Barofsky refused to do that. In fact, he wrote a book about it, which is just coming out this week. And we've got to get him on this radio show to talk about this topic because it was just, you know, just mind blowing. And here's more evidence of this. Half of all home borrowers under 40 years old or underwater on their mortgage. A lot of them were buying their first home, or maybe it was their second home, but they were just new into the market and they were buying at the bubble, and bang, it burst. This is just killing young people. I mean, it's killing everybody, but both metaphorically and literally, we are seeing suicide rates go up. Just like, you know, I've shared with you so many times that old BBC article about, not old, it was about 10 years ago, but it was a study that was done over a 100-year period. But they found that in the UK, whenever a conservative government came into power, suicides went up. And whenever a Labour Party, a Liberal Party came into power, suicides went down in the UK. And I would submit to you that, you know, some of what we're seeing in some of these massacres and things are just variations on suicide. So, you know, kind of suicide by cop or suicide by whatever. It's, you know, people just feeling like, you know, enough already. And, or I can't handle it anymore. And I can tell you how I feel about surgery, but this is the sad state of America right now. And it's because of this ideology that says we should just turn it all over to the big corporations. You know, the hell with everybody else. Turn it over to the big corporations. We don't need government. Government's an evil thing. We don't need planning. That's pointy-headed liberals who think they know what's best. We don't need, you know, regulations. That's, you know, people trying to protect others. Come on, people can protect themselves. You know, they buy some patent medicine from the guy with the you know, at the back of his station wagon in the drive-in parking lot, and sew it in a little mercury or arsenic in it. Hey, it might make you feel better. I mean, this is not just their philosophy. This is where they're trying to take us. They're trying to take us back to the late 19th century. These Republicans. And it is just so wrong. Alan in Gary, Indiana. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind?
Yes, sir. First of all, Tom, I hope you keep coming along with your surgery and hope everything goes well for you.
Thank you. I'm expecting that tomorrow when they pull these tubes out of me, that's going to be the end of it, and Monday I'll be back in the studio and sounding more rational and reasonable. Thank you for your kind wishes, Bill.
I am a retired person. I am conservative. But I do twirl the dial. I listen to all the stations left and right. And I'm not going to get in any big... But my main concern, Tom, and you seem to be one of the guys who seems to have some knowledge and some intellect on both sides, I would like to have you explain to probably all of us the $1.5 trillion deficit every year. And to my understanding, even if we tax to the hilt on the richest part of the people and whatever, the richest people, there's probably about a third or four-tenths of a trillion, $400 billion that would become available. That still leaves about over a trillion dollars in debt.
Yeah, the assumption there, first of all, if we went back to the tax levels that we had during Eisenhower and Nixon and Johnson and Kennedy and whatnot, where corporations were paying 37-38% of total federal tax receipts, right now they're paying 7%. And where the rich were paying 74%, right now Mitt Romney's paying 13%. If we went back just to those levels, because people are trying to take us back to Clinton levels, I mean, they're saying go back to Clinton levels, you're not going to have enough money. That's true. But secondly, you're not going to have enough money because we're in the middle of a recession. If you started spending money, this is how, you know, we were at 127% of GDP in debt after World War II. Dwight Eisenhower got us out of it by spending money. He built the highway system. That's what we need.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's called good old-fashioned stimulus, and it works. And it's been proven over and over and over again. And what we're seeing in Europe is the countries that refuse to do it, they're going down in flames. Austerity's killing them.
Everybody's out. It started with a whisper.
And just a reminder, the third hour of our program, Senator Bernie Sanders is going to drop by. We're going to do brunch with Bernie on Thursday this week. It'll be today. And it should be a whole lot of fun. Looking forward to that. So be sure and stick around for that as well. Mike in Charleston, South Carolina. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I enjoy your show a lot.
Thank you.
Rarely agree with you, but I do enjoy the show. My question has to do with a topic that I hear you and Senator Sanders, when he's on, talk an awful lot about, is the need for the wealthy to pay their fair share of taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're really sort of having the wrong debate from the standpoint that I think it's really more discussion of how unfair the tax system needs to be to support the cost of government, from the standpoint that if, for example, you and I go...
Well, hang on just a second. Let me just correct. Let's, instead of saying the cost of government, let's say the functions of government, because you and I may agree that they're not always done well, but there are functions that are legitimate functions of government that have to be paid for.
Fair enough. No problem.
Okay.
I'll concede that. Okay. So the point being, to use maybe a simple analogy, if you and I go out to dinner and we order the same thing from the menu... a fair way to split the bill is that you pay half and I pay half. Would you agree with that?
Generally speaking, unless, you know, you're my brother-in-law who hasn't had a job in years and you're broke and I'm making a pretty good income, and it just, you know, it seems like, hey, I ought to pick up the bill. Not that my brother-in-law's broke. He's not, but you know my point.
There's
always exigent circumstances.
So the next step, I guess, would be, if I make, you know, $1,000 a year and you make $100,000 a year, should you pay 100 times as much taxes as I do?
Oh, I think I should pay more. But here's the big question, Mike, and this is what gets lost in the dialogue so much. First of all, let me just ask you a simple, straightforward, no, there's no gotcha here. This is just a straightforward question. Do you believe that at some level, we can debate where that level should be, but that you know, when the founders talked about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, when George Washington signed the first legislation to pay for a poorhouse, you know, in Washington, D.C., to provide medical care and housing for poor people, do you believe that there is some point at which we do have an obligation to take care of the most unfortunate among us, the widows, the orphans, the people who are disabled, and that that's a legitimate function of government? Are we in agreement on that?
I would say that is a charitable function, and I would not necessarily argue that the government doesn't need to address some of those services. But what I would argue is that the statement that it is fair for wealthy people to pay more taxes than other people,
right.
And that is the dogma that I hear from, you know, the progressive side, is that that's fair. And I would argue that it's not fair. It may be a necessity.
The fact of the matter is, right now, I mean, of the Fortune 400 wealthiest individuals in America last year, and these were all people who were making, you know, millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, in some cases billions of dollars, 100 out of those 400 paid no taxes whatsoever. Most of them were paying taxes under 20%. Now, you know, the most of the people who worked on me in the hospital were paying more than 20% taxes. You know, working people pay more than 20% taxes. So, A, we've got a situation in America where rich people, corporations, I mean, ExxonMobil, the most profitable corporation in the history of the world, paid no taxes. In fact, they got a tax rebate. Plus, we're providing them with you know, using our Navy, with keeping the shipping lanes clear and all that. We don't charge them a penny for that. We don't charge them a penny for the cancers that are caused downwind from the refineries in Louisiana and Texas and Cancer Alley there. You know, we pay all that. We absorb all that. But the real issue here, I think, is, you know, is there some truth to the old Karl Marx dictum that, you know, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs? And I, personally, and I'm not a Marxist, I think that Marx's analysis of why societies, particularly unregulated capitalist societies, eventually become totalitarian societies and become oligarchies, I think his analysis is right. I think his prescription was completely wrong. I mean, you know, communism doesn't work.
Yeah.
But the question that we have to ask ourselves is, how much is enough? At what point do we say, okay, you could live on that, right? You're making $100 million a year. You can live on that. And if you're not making $200 million this year, but instead only making 100, because we're taking the other 100 in taxes, if that means that you can walk down safe streets and that kids aren't begging and following you around and that the guy sitting next to you isn't coughing with tuberculosis and that we have a more civil and sane society, I think that's a reasonable thing. I think that there's a, you know, maybe it's because I've lived in Europe for a year and I've spent a lot of time there, and I've spent a lot of time in third world countries. I mean, on four different continents. And what I see over and over again is in those countries where you've got basically oligarchies, you know, Mexico, you got 38 families that control Mexico, Colombia, you got about, I think it's 23 families control Colombia. Basically, a small handful of billionaires run the politics and everything else. And then you've got this huge class of the working poor. It's not safe. It's not healthy. It's not good for society. And then you look at countries like Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Germany, France, all of which proudly call themselves socialists, although not in the way that Marx meant it, and certainly not the way that the Soviet Union meant it. And life is quite good. People are working really well. It's like, you know, that German businessman who was interviewed by Bloomberg News the other day, and he's a very wealthy businessman, very successful German businessman. And the guy interviewing him was an American, and he said, how much are you paying taxes? And the guy said, about 54%. And the American was just horrified. He said, 54%, more than half of your income's going to taxes. And he says, yeah, it's fine. I'm making a very, very good living right now. I got my house. I got a couple Mercedes. I got a plane. I'm doing fine. And then the guy came back to it again, you know, 10 minutes later, you know, are you sure? You know, look at all these taxes you're paying. And finally, this guy said, listen, I would rather be a rich man or a well-off man in a rich country than a rich man in a poor country. And the debate I think, Mike, you and I are having, and the debate that I think America needs to have, is where is that leveling point? You know, where's the pivot point for the teeter-totter on that thing where you say, okay, Now we're taking too much from people. Now we're not taking too much, and we're not asking enough of people, as it were. And we're not having rational discussions about this, instead it's bumper slogan stuff that people are throwing at each other. Am I making sense here, Mike?
Again, I guess I would argue that, you know, the very statements that you're making are that perhaps it may be necessary to take more, but that does not make it fair.
Sure. I would copy that. And I would also point out to you that history shows that when the top tax rate, after you've earned your first $1 million in a year, and you start on your millionth and first dollar, when that top tax rate is below 50%, then that country will have, within a decade, a serious bubble and crash. Whereas when that top tax rate, after that first $1 million, is above 50%, so people just typically don't take the money. They keep the money in their business. They invest, they grow their business, they you know, do those kinds of things. Then you don't have bubbles and crashes. And you can see this. I mean, just graph the history of the U.S. income tax and the history of U.S. recessions, and you will see it just here in the United States. You can see it in a dozen different European countries. You know, I wrote a whole chapter about this in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. So there's a very practical economic reason for this as well that has to do with not flooding the market with hot money. Because when people, you know, somebody's already earned $1 million, now they're going to earn 2-3 more million. It's more than they can spend. So what do? They go looking for risky investments. And risky investments means bubble economy. Bubble economy means you got a disaster coming down the road.
But again, progressive politicians and progressive talk show hosts, like you, for example, never use the word necessary. They use the word fair. And I think that's disingenuous.
Well, I would say that it's both. I think that if, you know, there have been times in my life when I've had a very, very good income, and there have been times in my life when I was literally on unemployment. And the impact that I was having on society was different. And I think that's true right across the board. You know, if you've got a lot of money, then all those banking regulators, they're working for you. They're not working, you know, if you're the guy with a lot of money, they're working for the billionaires, right? They're looking out to protect their assets. They're not protecting the assets of the average working person. So, of course, they should pay more for that.
As a practical matter, I would argue that the real argument that progressives should use, and one that I would support, as to why rich people need to pay more than others, is that they have more to lose if the system collapses.
That's an excellent point, and it's true.
That's different. That's different than fairness.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, I don't use fairness so much. Bernie likes to use it, and I respect that. I think that there are practical reasons for progressive taxation, and you know, practical ones that have to do with, well, I've already described them, so I don't need to be redundant here. But
I appreciate you taking my call.
Yeah, good talking with you, Mike. Thanks a lot. It's nice to hear a conservative who's up for a rational conversation. There's far too few of those these days in America. But this is you know, in my mind, this really is one of the debates that we need to be having, particularly when you've got two millionaires on the Republican ticket. You got multimillionaire Paul Ryan, and you got, you know, half a billionaire Mitt Romney. And these guys are paying very low income taxes, Mitt Romney in particular. You know, what is an appropriate level of taxation? How do we make a country work?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And how do we convince people, like in Tampa, that there is a way to make a city that's not just a city, but livable, a place where people want to raise their kids? Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and live on the radio. At least we're here, you know. Tubes and weird things sticking out of me, but I couldn't make it into the studio today. My apologies, but I figured a live show is better than the alternative. So, and special thanks to Shane and Jim and Paul and all the folks who guest hosted for me throughout the week you know, it is much appreciated. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Tom, glad to hear your voice and keep the faith, okay?
I'll do it.
All right. Okay, buddy. Look, the Obama campaign and Mitt Romney, I believe, I'm going to suggest to you that 25 years in advanced technology and corporate money changers and what they are, 25 years in advance in their research. And so what they're going to do is attempt to create fear by throwing everything out there they can to remove our rights and strategy to see where our weakness and strengths are. And by doing this, they're going to get us to accept their attempt to cripple the economic stability of the United States and then restructure America.
They're already doing it. They're turning us into a third world country. There's a really good, it wasn't Thorsten Veblen, but it was one of those Norwegian or Northern European economists slash philosophers from the turn of the last century. Might have been Thorsten Veblen, but I don't think so. But anyhow, he pointed out that when you look at revolution, and I'm not talking just about, you know, like the French Revolution, the American Revolution, where people are shooting each other and guillotines and things, but, you know, revolutions like what happened in the Soviet Union when it fell, or what happened here in the United States with the FDR administration or the LBJ administration, you know, civil rights and the Great Society. When you look at moments when societies genuinely change, they genuinely recalibrate, the thing that provokes that, arguably the Reagan Revolution as well, although he wasn't as explicit about what he was doing, it was more of an inside job. But the thing that provokes that is not how bad things have gotten. People can put up with it a whole awful lot. I mean, I lived for a week in the slums in Bangkok when Bernie Cooper was working there, you know, with the Dwang Pratip Foundation. And, right. You know, they got nothing. I mean, they got nothing. And, you know, life ain't bad. People get to know each other. There's a sense of community. I was quite astounded, actually, by it. It was a really good learning experience for me. But the point is that that's not what produces revolution. What produces revolution is when the gap between expectation and reality grows to a certain width, and it's quantifiable. When it grows to a certain width, that's when you start seeing people blow up. And that's why you'd see people in rich countries like England or Greece, where people are out in the streets, you know, setting cars on fire. And you know, somebody from Zimbabwe is looking at that going, hey, wait a minute, I haven't eaten in a week. And these people
are...
Let me ask
you this, Tom. Is it possible that the reason why the people are holding these revolutionary actions is because they've experienced the good life, and then when they're thrown the bad life, they react to it? But now, let me suggest this as well, that they throw us the bone, so they throw us the good stuff, and when we get a taste of it, they already expect, they've already conditioned and preconditioned us to react this way. They are advanced. So the only thing that can resolve this is to do the unexpected. When we think out of the box that they put us in, we're on the monopoly.
Well, let me just take your original hypothesis and my point about, you know, that gap between expectation and reality, and just take it one step further. And I think that you'll find that we agree. We may use very different language to describe this, and that is that had, you know, right now, the average American family is making $3,000 a year less than they were when Ronald Reagan came into office. When Reagan came into office, we were the largest exporter in the world of manufactured goods. Today, we're the largest importer. We're the world's largest third world country. When Reagan came into office, we were the largest importer in the world of raw materials, and we converted them into TVs and cars and washing machines and shipped them out. Today, we're now the world's largest exporter of raw materials. We've become the mining pit for much of the rest of the world. When Reagan came into office, we were the largest creditor nation in the world. More countries owed us money than ever before in the history of the world. Today, we're the largest debtor country in the world. So 35 years of Reaganomics has done incredible damage. When Reagan came into office, student debt was largely unheard of. I mean, it was rare, and it was low. Now you've got over $1 trillion in student debt. When Reagan came into office, the banksters didn't have the right or the power to screw you. Now they do. Had all those changes, which took place over a 30-year period, had all those taken place in a 5-year period, there would have been a revolution. But because it happened over a 30-year period, you got people in their 20s, 30s, even early 40s, who have no recollection of life before Ronald Reagan. And so they don't know. Go ahead.
So if Obama does get reelected, and I believe that he will be, because they are not ready for us to experience the Romney era. They're not ready yet. They've got to make the economy a little bit better so they can bring in, probably after Obama gets out, then they can bring us down, create another war, create economic chaos more. They're going to fix the economy. I believe that. Obama's going to get reelected. But then the next 4 years after that, they're going to bring somebody else in that's going to tear us down, and that fits the hypothesis that we've been talking about.
Well, I think the problem, Michael, is that, you know, structurally our economy has already been torn down. You know, our ability to regulate our own trade is no longer there. The jobs are not coming home, and it's not because of the free market or any of these other kind of economic rationalizations. It's because we changed our laws, and we need to change them back. I mean, there's fundamental, you know, we need to reunionize America. We need to bring manufacturing back. We need to, you know, it's pretty straightforward, simple stuff. And because it's not being done, we are, you're absolutely right, we are set up for another fall. And you know, hopefully that fall will produce the kind of real change, you know, where we're moving in the FDR direction. So we'll see how it works out. But, Michael, you're onto something. Thanks a lot for the call. And we'll be back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program, live from Washington, D.C. Oh, by the way, Holland, the socialist. Victory is near. What is going on in Europe? I'll tell you all about that and what it means for us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, we started out the last hour talking about how Tampa is a great example of Republican laissez-faire, Ayn Rand, Paul Ryan philosophy of, you know, just let the big corporations and the rich people decide, you know, what should be where. Let the so-called marketplace, controlled by those people, decide, you know, there should be a shopping center here and a housing here and like that. And don't give any thought to people who actually study these things and understand that, you know, if you have mixed-use housing, for example, if you have homes in the, you know, where upstairs and downstairs there's stores that people don't need to then buy cars, you know, and things like that. I mean, so anyway, we started with that. And there's been this fad going on. You know, it started in the United States and the UK back in 1978 when Maggie Thatcher got elected. And it became kind of the absolute way in 81 when Ronald Reagan was sworn in here in the United States. And it has held sway to this day, they call it neoliberalism in Europe. We call it conservative economics, trickle-down economics, trickle-on economics, supply-side economics. You know, they've tried to come up with a bunch of different ways to label it. It's basically this conservative notion, and that government has no useful function, and that therefore we should have that it's a good thing for there to be very little government, very few regulations, very little control, and that if you want to make the country healthier, you do that by shrinking the size of government. Well, they've been trying that in Europe. And Holland, which is not one of the countries that is, you know, in great crisis like Greece, Holland is looking at this and they're saying, you know, those countries that have cut back on public sector employees, those countries that have cut their minimum wage, they actually cut the minimum wage in Greece. They cut health benefits in Greece. You know, they those countries that have done these kinds of cuts, they are suffering for this. They're in pain for this. And so here comes this headline. Judy Lynn posted this over at the Democratic Underground. Quote, this is the headline by Matt Steinglass, Dutch socialists' sense of victory is near. You know, people used to call us dirty communists, as Flinkje Carl Boot, a 20-year-old member of the Socialist Party in DMN, a working class suburb of Amsterdam. Now they come up to us and say we're doing good work. And this is from the Financial Times, by the way. Matt Steinglass points out the sea change in the Dutch mood experienced by Carbloot and others. Well, it comes after 18 months of conservative government. Yep, they had a conservative government in Holland, in the Netherlands, for the last 18 months, year and a half. With austerity policies and the Eurozone crisis driving widespread disaffection. And they're even speculating that again, to quote from the Financial Times, if the party takes the Netherlands out of the German-led camp of countries pressing for stricter EU budgetary supervision in exchange for rescue measures, it could shift the balance of power in Europe as a whole. In other words, all of Europe might say, you know, this is nuts. This stuff is nuts. Look at what's happening in the United States, red states versus blue states. In those states where you've got governors like Rick Scott, who said, no, we don't need any money to build high rail in Tampa, from Tampa to Orlando to Miami, forget about it. We're not going to take your money. We're not going to put those people to work. We're gonna wait for the magic of the free market. We're gonna wait for some billionaire to come down here, some rich guy, or some big transnational corporation, maybe some Saudi corporation, or Chinese corporation, or Brazilian corporation, or whatever. They're gonna come in here and they're gonna say, you know, we could build a factory here to make what? Well, that's a good question. Maybe shoes or widgets or whatever. We're gonna build a factory here. We're just gonna wait for the magic of the market to work. And increasingly, people are seeing that not only is that crazy, it doesn't work. It just plain old flat out doesn't work. And 30 years of Reaganomics is hollowed out America. And it's time for us to get back to a basic understanding of how economies work. It is straightforward stuff, my friend. Jay in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hope you get better real quick. Got to get that in there. I was listening to one of your callers a bit earlier, one of the conservative callers. You had a real kind of a nice conversation with the past hour. And he was talking about fairness. I think obviously he was upset because people who feel like they have to pay more or carry more of the burden, they get real angry. And you're being rational with them, but I know you've noticed this, but those guys are inciting a lot of anger in people, and they tell them it's not fair, and people aren't pulling their weight. And I don't know that rationality is going to overcome the anger of these people. I mean, you've seen the footage of these people at the rallies, just
talking about Tea Party rallies.
Oh yeah, they hate Obama with a passion that's just like white hot. And they think they call him a socialist. All these things that have nothing to do with the truth. And what disturbs me is that on your half-hour news update there, they say that there's a possibility that that might work once again, and he might lose the election.
But Obama might.
Yeah.
There's speculation on both sides, and it's going to be a squeaker, particularly given the big hundreds of millions to billions of dollars that are going to get dropped out of the sky in the last three, 4 weeks before this election. It is going to be, I mean, it's just going to be blotto. It's going to be unbelievable. And the question is, are Americans going to buy this stuff and then vote Romney in? Because he's not running on platform. He's running on, you know, trying to tear down Obama and with a bunch of demonstrable lies. Are the American people going to believe it? Or are the American people, as happened in California in the cases of Carly Fiorina and Meg Whitman, who tried to buy their elections for U.S. Senate and governor, respectively, are the American people going to say, wow, look at all that money, look at all those ads? You know, these 26 cranky billionaires who are funding most of this, you know, and make most of their money either on Wall Street or in the oil industry, they're really trying to screw us. And I am hopeful that people are going to get it and the latter is going to happen. I am worried that the former might happen. But either way, I think our republic will survive. I just think the question is, are we going to have a couple more years of hard times, or are we going to have another decade of hard times? If the Republicans are elected, particularly if they get more right-wingers on the Supreme Court, we might have a generation of hard times.
Well, the best part about that conversation with the guy was at the very end, he kind of did admit that you had a point, and that it's the feeling of this and the sense of anger because people pay more into taxes. They think that these people are freeloaders, and I don't believe that the truth is, well, you know, no, but the point that he made was that if he's paying more into it, he has more of a vested interest in the system working for him, so he should pay more into it, and that is rational thinking. I'll give him that, but it's
kind of like more out of the system too.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, the real poor people don't really have a lot of Well, unless you feel like it's kind of like expecting the slaves to fight for the early United States. They didn't have a lot of vested. In fact, they might have wanted that system to crumble. Whereas people today, if they don't feel like they have a lot invested in the system, I don't know that they'll fight for it if they feel like they have something.
Are you suggesting that working people who are making so little that they don't pay federal income taxes, they just pay state taxes and sales taxes and things, that they should be paying taxes so they'll feel like they got skin in the game?
Well, I'm saying that the amount of skin that people have in the game is probably the calculus that decides.
I don't think so. I don't think anybody looks at their taxes at the end of the year and says, I'm going to decide how patriotic I am based on how much I'm paying taxes. I'm going to decide how much skin I've got in the game of this country. I think people either love this country or they don't. They have a vision for it or they don't. Or they have a variety of them. I would strongly disagree with that. I've heard that a lot of times, the big argument for Romney raising taxes on all the working people and cutting taxes on billionaires. And I think it's wrong, Jay, frankly. But, time will tell. Thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, what's the latest with Todd Akin? We'll check in on that and more right after. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Doing my very best here, broadcasting from bed with tubes and holes and all kinds of weird things in me, but hopefully all this stuff will get fixed up at the hospital tomorrow. On Monday, I will be back in fine form in the studio using a little bit better audio. We're broadcasting from the boat here where we don't even have a phone line out to it. So we're doing our best. We're doing our absolute best and working as hard as we can to produce a program that you'll enjoy listening to and being part of. I hope it's working for you. And my apologies in particular to our radio station owners who are so very often and so correctly concerned about audio quality and things that we couldn't make this any better. But also, I didn't expect to be on death's door and in a hospital emergency room for 4 days. And so we're doing the best we can here. And I'm coming back. I'm coming back well and fast. Mike in Topeka, Kansas. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm glad to see you're feeling a little better. I just wanted to call and kind of remind people that whenever we're talking about the billionaires and the millionaires, and the money that they've made and whether, what's fair for them to pay in on taxes, et cetera, they've made that money, a lot of it, off of the backs of the middle class. I'm not sure where they would be if it wasn't for the workers.
Sure. Somebody's got to make something.
And that seems to have been lost on a lot of people. And the last thing I'd like to say is it's awful. I've worked with the poor all my life, which is I'm almost 60 now. And it's real easy to say that they're lazy and whatever, and we don't need to worry about those people. But what I found is that the individuals that say that feel that way until they end up in the same boat. Mm. And that's another thing that I think we've forgotten about somewhere along the line.
Yeah, karma's a tough one. Yep. Mike, excellent observations. Thanks for calling and sharing them with us. Well said. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you. I wish the best, my best prayers to you and your wife.
Thank you, Frank.
What I today's notice, I just realized in the news that someplace in Colorado, some university said they predicted the presidential election for the past 8 elections.
Right. Yeah, now, I read that too.
They
predicted that Romney's going to win.
Yeah. My problem is, what if Romney wins and the Senate, like in Massachusetts, we have a pretty lackluster campaign. But I want to know what's going to happen because here's the problem. The real nut of the problem is I saw a guy, Hugh Hewitt, with this hideous grin, talking about the first 100 days of the Romney administration would be to talk about deconstructing or Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Yeah.
And it scared the hell out of me. This guy with this hideous grin, and he was in a group of people from Yorba Linda, California, you know, Nixon country.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, maybe that's just that the reaction of that group. But now, with today's news that Romney might win, you know, it scared the hell out of me. But these people, now here's the point. I just recently read William Shirer's Rise and Fall of the Third Empire. And
very right,
take
amazing book,
the
isn't
theory.
It?
Yeah. Now I saw yesterday you mentioned about Hitler, so I don't want to talk about him. But they didn't take these people seriously. It's not just Hitler. Mm-hmm. It's the whole thing. They didn't take these people seriously that right. They were going to do all this.
We didn't take Reagan seriously either. And look at that, what a horrible mistake that was, you know.
My father was a Reagan Democrat. I couldn't believe it,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and all those mergers and acquisitions started happening and Greed is Good and Gordon Gekko and all that, you know, that should have been the biggest alarm bell. It should have been rockets in the sky, you know. And instead, everybody was like, oh, hey, gravy train, we can hop on this one. And then he cut taxes on millionaires and billionaires and raised more than doubled the largest tax increase in history on working people. And somehow that one slid by. And it's just incredible. You know, what has happened in this country?
Yeah.
And they
brought up
nature
the Lapica curve. Where the only point that they can agree on is the initial point had zero taxes, zero revenue, and that 100% taxes, zero, you know, 100% revenue. That's the only two points. You know,
yeah.
What kind of a crazy thing is this going on? You know, and these are the people who are like Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney talking about this crazy stuff. You know, and people are believing it. I know. I talk to people around me. They say, yeah, you know, we need it. Well. Well, you know, they say we need a change. What do you mean? What are you, nuts?
Now, people are buying the big lies. You know, oh, yeah, did you know that Obama took $700 billion out of Medicare? Well, actually, no, he didn't. He took most of that money out of Medicare Advantage, which was a privatized program that accrued most of its benefits to United Healthcare Company so that its CEO could take over $1 billion in income and, you know, cleaned up fraud and waste. For example, but you know, even not just Romney's ads are lying about it. Romney himself is lying about it. It's amazing. Frank, thanks a lot for the call. I am concerned too about what happens if the Republicans get control. Will they pull a Reagan and actually fundamentally change America, or will they just talk about it and just keep spending money more like George Bush did? We'll see.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with more of your calls. This is interesting. I'm sick and tired of poor people complaining, followed by somebody saying, justice, not charity, poor work the hardest. We got some interesting calls coming up.
Don't stop believing.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Glad to be with you live on this Thursday. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders is going to be with us in another, 30 minutes or so? Yeah, thereabouts. And but between now and then, we're picking up your calls. Yolanda in San Bernardino, you know, I think I misread the thing about you that you're not complaining about poor people. And let me let you speak in your
hi.
Own words. Hey.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How you doing? I'm glad that you're back. I wanted to talk about... you know how everybody's always cutting us down, people who are poor in this country and,
mm-hmm.
and all the Republicans and all that, you know. Anyways, there's a lot of our generation that was raised on social assistance, who have disabilities, who have ADHD. You're well familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I myself am like this. And, you know, I found out that I have other problems since then, but I think a lot of the problem, I don't know if I'm a good example, but I think that there's an awful lot of people like me in this country, you know. What do you think about that? I mean, and they're picking on us all the time, but they made
you
it.
Meaning
you know?
that you're disabled in some way and,
yeah,
and
like
poor
ADHD,
and,
like,
and you,
you know, with neurobiological disorders or, you know, like in my case,
yeah.
I seem very intelligent, and I am, but I have other problems, like, for instance, just with being organized with my,
because
I have Tourette's and ADHD.
Yeah.
So,
and you'd like to contribute to society and make a contribution to society, and I think that we need to be organizing things in our country in ways that are...
Yeah, but then we do too much for our children. I see all the people who are raising their kids now, of like, I'm Hispanic, and I see people just do too much for their kids. And I'm totally,
well, that's a whole different thing.
You know, I'm Mormon, but I'm a Democrat, and, well, I don't know about that really, but you know what I mean?
You're a walking contradiction,
Alana.
I'm just
kicked on all the time. You know,
okay.
And we're just trying to make it. And it's so hard, and we're like the ones that get picked on so much.
I know.
I'm sick of it, you know, and we have enough challenges as it is.
The great tragedy of America, Yolanda, and thanks for the call. You said it very, very well. The great tragedy of America is that the poor don't vote. And when they try to vote, right now the Republicans are trying to suppress their vote. And they've already successfully knocked about 5 million off the polls. And that's one of the great tragedies of America, is that the people who are most impacted by government policies, the Koch brothers could say, oh, we're usually impacted, but, you know, they got $50 billion. Come on, let's go. But the people who are really genuinely impacted by government policies tend not to participate. Some of them out of cynicism. Some of them are just dead poor because they're disabled, they're broke, they're suffering physical or mental disabilities that prevent them from participating in the workplace. Some of them just because of accidents of birth. You know, they were born in Appalachia, and the coal mines are going away. They're being replaced by strip mines, and there's just nothing left, and the land's been raped, and what are you going to do? But there needs to be an effort to get more folks, the broad cross-section of America, out there and voting. Mark in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, how you doing? I was a poor laborer, and I used to organize poor laborers for power, And I just want to say that I think it's really an outrage to characterize progressive taxation as charity. I mean, I think, you know, poor people really work harder than anybody. Poor people work 2-3 jobs for nickels, you know what I'm saying? I mean, the most undesirable work pays the least. I mean, there should be no such thing as the working poor. I mean, that's an outrage in itself. I really think that it's really justice, not charity, to tax progressively. And I think that that's been the strategy of the right since the 80s. To characterize progressive taxation and social programs as charitable gestures, you know, rather than justice. I think, you know, see, the thing is, I think it has to be seen as the just compensation of working people for their work. What the employers don't pay in wages, they're going to pay in taxes. And if they refuse to do either, what's going to happen is that the middle class will be destroyed and working people will be pauperized. You know, I think that it has to be seen as a just compensation. I think it's really insult to injury to try to make poor people into charity cases. You know, poor mm-hmm. working people into charity cases. I think it's
I'm with you. It's on the one hand, on the one hand, we have to provide as a society for the people who can't provide for themselves, and for that very small sliver of people who won't provide for themselves. There's always going to be some freeloaders. It's going to be 1-3%, but there's always going to be those people in our society. They've always been with every society, and that's just the cost of it. You know, it's just like, you know, you open a retail store and you know you're going to lose a certain percentage of shoplifters. It's just the cost of doing business. And we have to acknowledge that. And at the same time, we have to put these programs in place in ways that produce good outcomes, that do provide for people during times of economic distress like we have right now, and that, you know, take care of their basic needs. So, you know, solidly with you, Mark. Well said. Thank you. Terry in Smith River, California. Hey, Terry, thanks for listening to AM 1480. What's up?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. First time caller, and, I guess I would be considered a conservative, and I come from a little community, and I know that you talk mainly against Reagan and what his policies have done, but I go back to what has happened in our community here since Obama has taken over the helm, and we have a 13.8 unemployment. We have 46% of the people here on food stamps. We have 32% of the new small businesses shut down in the last 4 years, and we've had over 1,873 foreclosures. And this was just information that came out of the Sunday paper. So,
and you think this is Obama's fault?
I think he hasn't done what he promised he would do. And I think most of the things that he has stressed has been on a social basis
Who's responsible for this social disaster that you just described? Because an awful lot of that is 10, 20, 30 years old, and you and I both know it. The hollowing out of manufacturing in America, the destruction of our public school system, these vast changes in our culture, these are not things that President Obama did.
I think what you were saying before about jobs going overseas, and you know, we were the greatest exporter, now we're an importer. I think that has a lot to do with the cost of doing business. The unions, I mean, I ran a business years ago, and three times the union came in to, you know, bust my company due to the fact that I had 119 employees, and three times the people in the company voted it down. And we were fair. They participated in the profit structure. They had.
Well, that's the good thing about a union is that a union is a democratic institution. And if you can't get half the people to say, yeah, I want to be a member of a union, then there's no union. As an employer, you can have it, you know, either way. But the point is not that the unions are destroying America. It's the other way around. If anything, if you track the decline in union membership since the Reagan administration to today, and you track that along with the decline in wages of working people, it follows almost one to one.
I mean, how can you compete, though, with somebody that you're paying with benefits and such over $50 an hour when you're competing with somebody overseas that's getting less than $6, $7 an hour? I mean, there's no way you can compete.
How do the Germans do it?
I don't know how they do it. All I know is that their taxes are very high, and so the government subsidizes a lot of the things that is done in the country.
The government's not doing much subsidy over there. The way that the Germans are doing it, you know, your question is a good question, and I it sounded rhetorical, but I'm guessing that there's, you know, that you meant it as a genuine question, you know, and that is, how do you make an economy that works? Is it possible even to make an economy that works? How do you compete with $2 an hour labor coming out of Honduras or you know, Vietnam or something like that? And the way that you do it is what the Germans have done, what the Taiwanese have done, what the South Koreans have done, what the Japanese have done, what the Chinese have done, what the Brazilians are doing now. You know, the Brazilians, you know, the largest company in the world right now is Apple, and Foxconn makes their phones. And Brazil last year passed a law that said that any phone not manufactured in Brazil, there's a 50% import tax when that thing hits our borders. And what did Foxconn do? They built a factory in Brazil, put 1,000 people to work. I mean, this is simple stuff. There are countries that are doing really, really well because they're following rational trade policies. And we're doing really, really poorly because we've been stupid for the last 30 years.
I think the main thing is that...
And it's got nothing to do with Obama.
...work with each other. Well, I think Obama was supposed to come in with change and be the healer. And what has occurred in the last 4 years is that we have more hatred than we ever had in this country.
But it's not coming out of Obama. It really isn't, Terry. That what you are seeing, you had 19 members of Congress get together at the caucus room the night, there's this fancy restaurant here in Washington, D.C., the night of the inauguration, and basically swear a blood oath that they were going to do everything they could to block anything productive during the next 4 years of the Obama administration, keep the economy in the tank, keep the American people in pain, so that when 4 years comes down the road, Obama will be a one-term president and the Republicans will be seen as the saviors and they will bring America back. And that plan has been executed flawlessly. There's been an entire book written about it. Robert Draper wrote a whole book about that plan. And, you know, we've discussed it at some length on this program. And they've been executing that. And, I mean, you had a piece of, you know, we were talking about jobs. Nancy Pelosi passed out of the House of Representatives a law
that said that corporations can no longer take a tax deduction for doing what Bain Capital used to do, which is taking factories, taking them apart brick by brick, sending them over to China, and bringing the products into the country. You can't do that anymore. You get a tax break for it. More than 50 people voted for it in the Senate. The Republicans filibustered. It passed the House of Representatives.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This false equivalency stuff makes me crazy. It's not, you know, oh, yeah, both sides are corrupt, both sides. The Republicans are aggressive in trying to harm this country's political game. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and Shano and Jim and Paul holding down the fort back at the studio, and I hope either Monday, and Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us today. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, a number of things are up, actually. One thing that is going forward is that today the Department of Health and Human Services awarded new federal grants, giving several states the ability to create insurance exchanges under the new health care law. Now, they announced...
Wow. You mean like Vermont and Montana?
Well, actually, today, California, Connecticut, Hawaii, Iowa, Maryland, Nevada, New York, and Vermont received grants to support the creation of exchanges.
That is great.
Each state is at a different point in the process. Now, some Republican-led states, as you know, have said they'll decide on a course of action to create the states following the election. Mm. They're hoping that they won't have to do it because Mitt Romney's vowed to repeal the law that he could do, I guess, if they got Congress and the White House. Now, under the law, which the Supreme Court largely upheld in June, states that refuse to establish their own exchanges will see the marketplace created by federal health officials. And these exchanges, like the individual mandate to buy insurance, are not popular with people who oppose the health law, but they are moving forward, and several more moved forward today.
Right. Well, and one of the reasons why the drug companies and their shills are opposed to these exchanges is because it introduces true competition in the marketplace. Right now the pharmaceutical industry is largely exempt from antitrust regulation. And so they've just kind of carved up the country, and they just do what they're doing, and they figure out their prices, and they never, ever, ever lose money. And, something that might force them to compete with each other, that's got them a little nervous.
That's interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. There is a bit of a slap going on the reporting side, covering Mitt Romney today. Sean Boyd, a reporter for Denver CBS affiliate KCNC, was one of four local reporters to speak with Mitt Romney today. And she said on the air that the Romney campaign had set preconditions before allowing her to interview the candidate.
Really?
She said, I had about 5 minutes with him, and we got through a fair amount of material, actually, in that 5 minutes. The one stipulation to the interview was that I not ask him about abortion or Todd Akin. He's the Missouri Republican who created... She said, I did ask him about health care, the female vote, and energy.
Right.
And on Twitter.
Yeah, what is the... I mean, you're a real reporter, I barely play one on the radio.
I sort of play one, yes.
Yeah, but I don't even pretend that I'm a reporter. Actually, I'm a commentator, and I'm pleased to be it. But my question is, among your peers in your profession, when someone says, who is a high-profile person who, you know, we should be hearing the whole story from, and they should be able to be asked any question, somebody running for president, somebody running for the United States Senate, something like that, when they say, I will only give you an interview if you don't ask these questions, isn't the appropriate response to say, then there's not going to be an interview?
Yes. The only other response, and I just tweeted about this, would be to walk or ask.
Right.
Or ask anyway, and not pander. The only other way that I would do it would be to say, okay, and then during the interview to say, why do you not want me to ask you about these topics?
Yeah, that's.
I'm not going to ask you about these topics, but why are these topics off the list?
That's so elegant. That is so elegant, Victoria. I mean, that would be, you'd be sticking the knife in, you'd be exposing, you know, what they were doing, and, you know, without getting into the mud of the issue, as it were, that would be so elegant.
Yeah, but you know, I'd still have my access cut off.
You're right. It would. It could be, as happened with Helen Thomas, it could be the end of your career. And that's no small thing for most writing, most working journalists these days.
And that's the thing. This I mean, Sean Boyd went along with them. I'm sure they probably didn't think anything of it. But for many people, it's become normal, like it became normal just a couple of months ago for quotations from the White House to get approved, you know, we want that quote to be approved. And
right.
Suddenly the wire started to fight back, and McClatchy, I think, was the first to say, we will not do quote approval. And
yeah,
then
right.
others started to fall in line and said, we will not do quote approval, and it stopped.
Yeah, I don't think it should be happening on either. From either party on either side. I mean, you know, there's a reason why it's called the Fourth Estate. It's like the fourth branch of government. It's the branch of the unofficial branch of government that keeps the other ones honest.
Yeah.
At least in theory.
Other news. The SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, has finalized a contentious piece of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law aimed at cracking down on the use of conflict minerals from the militia-ravaged Democratic Republic of Congo.
Mm.
Companies will be required to disclose if they rely on minerals from the DRC under new rules adopted Wednesday.
Interesting.
It was a 3-2 vote. The two Republicans voted against.
Mm.
And this brings to a close a long-running fight. Basically, what will happen is the companies that rely on four minerals, tantalum, tin, gold, and tungsten, to manufacture their products will have to conduct a reasonable inquiry to determine where the minerals originated. And then, depending on what they find out, several series of things happen. If it didn't emerge from the DRC, they have to detail their findings. If they think it did come from the DRC, this happens, and then all kinds of things happen. But
which agency put this into place?
The Securities and Exchange Commission.
So this is going to apply to domestic American companies.
Correct.
Is that going to, I suppose it'll apply to international companies in as much as they've got to produce a product for the American market as well.
Right, but they don't have the power to punish them.
Right, fascinating. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Brunch with Bernie is going to happen this hour. Bernie's going to be with us. He's in a meeting right now. And, you know, this is not our normal time, so he's kind of planning around us, which is very, very kind to him to do. But I'm guessing it'll probably be 10 minutes or so before he hops on. But if you've got a question for Bernie, feel free to give a call. If you've got a question for me, say that again, Shane. Oh, 519. Okay, so 20 minutes after Bernie's going to be with us. So, meanwhile, and, you know, we can take your calls on whatever topic you'd like as well. But meanwhile, I've got to tell you about this. Victoria Jones touched on this in her news report as we went into the top of the last hour. But here it is on the campaign trail today. This by Annie Rose Strasser over at the Think Progress blog. On the campaign trail today, Mitt Romney refused to grant interviews to any reporters who wanted to know about his position on abortion. Their what? Or about Representative Todd Akin, the Senate candidate whose legitimate rape comment sparked outrage over the weekend from Democrats and Republicans alike. Sean Boyd, CBS correspondent, explained that only four local reporters got to talk to Romney because of these conditions. That's amazing. And I wonder, you know, if Sean Boyd is going to be punished for that. But you know, this is another symptom of how kind of broken and screwed up our system is now. That candidates feel that they can just say, nah, I'm not going to talk about that. I got billionaires behind me who are going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on this thing. And we're going to make up lies about Obama that he's taking money out of Medicare when he's not. He's actually making Medicare stronger. We're going to make up so many lies about this guy. You won't know him. Nothing new for the Republicans, by the way. Nothing new at all. Chris in Hancock, Michigan. Hey, Chris, what's on your line? What's on your mind?
Excuse me. Hey, Tom. Glad to hear that you're surviving. Yeah, question for you. That first guy who called up with the allegory about the lunch, he forgot a couple things that didn't match reality. First of all, it's not just two guys. One's maybe wealthier than the other. It's like one family and then about 50 families. And the 50 families order the side salad. And the other guy and his family order the 7-course filet mignon meal. And then the 50 families end up putting almost 3/4 of the bill, even though their total cost of what they got is far less than what the very wealthy family ate.
Yeah,
so
it's a very much better explanation of the metaphor, Chris. You're right.
Yeah, and then the other question I have is I would like to hear your response or Bernie's response on the minimum wage question.
The Democrats.
Whenever
I propose raising that to $10 an hour. I think that's a great thing.
Well, I do too, and for a number of reasons. But I want to get your take on it because whenever I bring that up, the response I get is it's going to kill small businesses. It's gonna. It's not going to do anything for the economy, and it's going to simply be another tax on the rest of us. Because why should I have to pay for somebody who works at McDonald's that's supposed to be a transition job when that cost of that higher wage is just going to be passed along to the consumer.
Yeah.
And I just, you know,
we have empirical evidence to answer those questions. And it's fairly straightforward. First of all, in the 1960s, the minimum wage adjusted for today's inflation was $10. And that was a period of time of the greatest prosperity in this country, greatest economic growth. And one of the reasons why was because somebody working at McDonald's or somebody doing a service job, you know, the Walmart greeter kind of job, although this predates Walmart. Those kind of people who had those kind of jobs, they made enough money that they could buy things with that money. They could, you know, they actually could have. I mean, it wasn't, you know, wonderful, wealthy lifestyle or something, but they could get by. And as a consequence of that, that created demand in the economy, which gooses the economy and says somebody's got to make the stuff that these people want to buy and all that kind of thing. So, one, we've had that experience. We've had a minimum wage of $10, and it was a little over $10, in fact, in the mid-60s. And in today's dollars. And we had a powerful economy as a consequence of it. It not only didn't hurt us, it helped us. And then secondly, you've got states that are examples. When I was living in Oregon, they raised the minimum wage, I believe, by $2. It might have been just $1, but they raised the minimum wage substantially. And they said for service workers who get tips, used to be that the minimum wage for them was $2 and then they'd get their tips. Now their minimum wage is going to be the, you know, eight, whatever it is, you know, the new minimum wage for the state, plus they get their tips. And the Restaurant Association was going, oh, this is going to be the end of us. We're all going to die. And, you know, the world's going to. No, nothing like that. It has worked out just fine for the state. And once again, it actually had a stimulative effect. People say, well, the cost is just going to be passed along to me. Pretty soon my burger is going to cost $8. My salad bar is going to be 30. Nonsense. The cost of labor is a very, very tiny slice of what you pay when you go into a restaurant. Food is a large slice. Rent is a large slice. Electricity is a large slice. But the cost of labor, particularly your service labor, is a very, very, very small piece of that. So, yeah, it might get passed along to you, but you'd never notice it.
But, and then the other side of that is the profit margin. I mean, it used to be that a profit margin of 20 or 25% was, or even 10, 15%, was enough to drive somebody to be in business. Now,
sure.
If you're not making 40, 50, 60% profit margin and socializing all the costs of doing your business, you know, back to that guy at lunch. He's using all the infrastructure and getting all the benefits of our highway system and all the benefits of all the regulations that monitor safety of the water, or et cetera. You know, they're getting the lion's share of the business and privatizing the profits by taking out 40-50% profit margin. Does that seem right?
That isn't right. And Chris, you've identified it very well. The tragedy is that this doesn't boil down to a bumper sticker. You know, don't raise my taxes. That boils down to a bumper sticker. Poor people are lazy. That boils down to a bumper sticker. All the myths and the stories and the craziness on the right, they figure out a way to boil it down to a bumper sticker. But maybe, you know, pay a fair wage and you'll get an economy that grows. I guess we need more effective think tanks, more people out there echoing the message.
I think we need just more people having the conversation in a rational, maybe emotional, but in a controlled emotional fashion. I just had an hour-long conversation with a number of people I work with in a hospital in a very Republican, very conservative area, almost libertarian. And it was amazing that the conversation pointed out that we agree on far more than we disagree on. And I think that's happening now. I think with the bat crap crazy wing of the ultra-right wing, people are starting to look at that and say, wait a minute, this isn't right. How do we deal with this? And they're getting away from the bumper stickers and more to the nuance.
Yeah, I think you're right. I hope so, too. Thanks a lot for the call. Carrie in New York City, a little less than a minute. Carrie, quick one.
Yeah, I'd like to know if you and some of the latest shares my concerns that after the November election, Democrats and Republicans are going to join together to support Simpson Bowles type approach to entitlement reform, which would end Social Security and Medicare mills and both by means testing them and raising age eligibility, which I see as a never ending slippery slope.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't know. Simpson Bowles never actually produced an official report. They couldn't get a consensus. And so the two of them would release their own little report that everybody refers to as if it was a real report. Means testing Social Security would destroy Social Security. It would turn it into a welfare program. It was never intended as one. It wasn't designed as one. It isn't one. But that would be the very real consequence of it. And raising the retirement age, as you said, it's just that is a slippery slope. If anything, we should be lowering the retirement age, which would get people in their 60s out of the labor force and open up jobs for young people.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And then those young people would be paying taxes into the Social Security system, and you'd actually see the system get stronger. You'd have more net tax inflow than you would tax outflow to the people who retire.
They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Program. It's our special brunch with Bernie, a day early because I'm not going to be around tomorrow. I've got to get back to the hospital and get all these tubes taken out of me. But Senator Sanders is on the line here with us and taking your calls. And Bernie, before we pick up any calls, usually you like to give us an overview of what's going on in your world, in the Senate, and in the country and things. You got a riff for us here.
Yeah, I think the major issue, at least one of the major issues that people have got to be paying keen attention to, is this issue of the fiscal cliff and this issue of deficit reduction. To my mind, what is going on right now is an effort led by billionaires like Pete Peterson and others to move forward toward deficit reduction and balancing the budget on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor. And I think certainly the entire Republican Party is going to be in on that, and you have a number of Democrats who will also be involved in that. And we've got to do everything we can to oppose that. Tom, in my view, what we can never forget is that when Bill Clinton left office in January 2001, this country was running a $236 billion surplus, and the economists were projecting that surplus to grow every single year. And we are in a deficit situation right now because some of these loudest so-called deficit hawks our people, George W. Bush and his friends, who took us into two wars, and they refused to pay for those wars. They gave huge tax breaks to the richest people in this country, and they refused to offset it. They passed a Medicare Part D prescription drug program, which was much more costly than it should have been, because they refused to have the government negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry. And then, of course, as a result of the Wall Street-caused recession, revenues compared to GDP are the lowest that they have been in 60 years. Businesses go under, workers lose their jobs, less tax revenue comes in to the federal government. And what these guys, the so-called deficit hawks, are now saying is that, yeah, well, maybe we caused a deficit with unpaid wars and tax breaks and the Medicare Part D program, but you know what, be that as it may, we've got to address the trillion-dollar deficit we have now and the $16 trillion national debt. And the way we think we should do it, we billionaires, we Wall Street guys, we think what we got to do is cut Social Security, despite the fact that Social Security hasn't contributed a nickel to the deficit. We've got to cut Medicare or do away with it as it currently exists, make it into a voucher program, force the elderly to pick up a lot more of the health care burdens, make devastating cuts to Medicaid, despite the fact we have 50 million people who have no health insurance right now, and they're going to cut kids off of health insurance, working families off health insurance. And by the way, we're so concerned about the deficit and the national debt that, you know, we'll try to get a few more tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires and large corporations. So there's a scam that's going on right now, and that is under the guise of trying to deal with what is a serious problem, deficit, the need to deal with the deficit, what you're going to see is a far-flung attack, a major, major attack on the elderly people, on the sick, on the children, on the poor, when, in fact, we do know that there are ways that you can deal with a deficit that is responsible and that is fair. And that is, you got to say to the billionaires of this country and the wealthiest people in this country who are doing phenomenally well, and we have to understand that we live in a time when the distribution of wealth and income is at a level we have not seen since the 1920s and worse than any other country on earth, that you got to say to the millionaires and billionaires and large corporations, you know what? We can't just have austerity for the middle class and the working class of this country. Those people have already been hit tremendously hard. You on top are going to have to deal with some austerity. We're going to have to ask the wealthy and the large corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes. We're going to have to take a hard look at military spending. So, and understand that we've tripled military spending since 1997. So I think, Tom, what you're going to see now, and it's really quite amazing, the collusion between the corporate media, Wall Street billionaires, politicians in Congress saying, oh, yes, we've suddenly woken up after we forgot to pay for two wars, which will cost us $3 trillion. We're going to have to cut Social Security. And after giving tax breaks to billionaires, we're going to have to cut Medicare and Medicaid. And we are going to have to fight that effort through grassroots organizing as effectively as we can.
Yeah. There you go. Dave, and are you ready to pick up calls?
Absolutely.
Okay, Dave in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, good afternoon. How are you doing today, you guys?
Good.
Tom, I hope you feel better and I hope you get well. Bernie, thanks for taking my call. My question is in regards to, as a fellow progressive, I mean, my vote this year is not going to Barack Obama. It's going to Dr. Jill Stein. My phone call to you, Bernie, is what are your opinions on Dr. Jill Stein and the Green Party? And as a fellow progressive, it's a shame to me, the fact you haven't endorsed them publicly. Is there any specific reason?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a very strong reason. Dave, you know, I am the longest-serving independent in the history of the United States of America. I've defeated Democrats. I've defeated Republicans. I think where we are right now is the Republican Party has moved from a right-center party to a right-wing extremist party. I think the Democratic Party has moved from a left-center party to what I would call a centrist party, some really great people, some pretty conservative people. But I think in the real world that we are living in right now, and I know that many people, including myself, are disappointed that Barack Obama has not done more to take on big money interest, to take on the Republicans. I fully appreciate that and share those concerns. But, Dave, to my mind, the task of this moment is to make sure that Mitt Romney is not elected president of the United States, that we do not have a Republican Senate, and continue to have a Republican House, all of which is quite possible. For a variety of reasons, I think, without going into all of the details right now, if you end up with a Romney and a Republican Congress, it is unimaginable the kind of devastation that they're going to do to the working families of this country. That's why I'm supporting Obama for re-election, and why I think we have got to, at the same time, grow a strong progressive grassroots movement.
Yeah, not to mention what they could do to the Supreme Court. All right. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's Brunch with Bernie a day early. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Check out sanders.senate.gov. Back with your calls for Bernie right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, a day early. Senator Bernie Sanders here taking your calls. And ready to go, Bernie?
Let's do it.
Okay. Don in San Diego, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I appreciate you having me on. Senator Sanders, I salute you. You are a hero to many of us in America, and I only wish I lived in your state so I could vote for you.
Thanks very much, Don.
I'd like to say a couple things. I think what's happening is the Republicans are focusing on the people least able to defend themselves by going over and going trying to get money from Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And as I've seen a couple charts, that entire segment of our budget is only 6%, whereas the military is 60%. So, and that doesn't include all the black programs. So to me, that's ridiculous. Number two, nuclear storage. Everybody's talking again about Yucca Mountain. I personally think it was built for another reason, and the geology is not good for nuclear storage, and I think a much more cost-effective way would be to utilize the military controlled areas in the southwest. There are huge tracts of land, and even, this sounds funny, Area 51, since they've had nuclear blasts there in the past.
Don, pardon my interrupting you, but do you have a question for Bernie?
Yeah, I'd like to find out if he thinks there's any chance to remove offshore tax havens for the ultra-rich.
Well, that's a good question, Don. Here's the view. Here's my view. When we look at the economy and we look at deficit reduction, what we have to understand is that the people on top have been extraordinarily successful winners in the economy. Tom, right now, the top 1% of this country owns 40% of the wealth. The bottom 60% owns only 2% of the wealth. The last year that we looked at income distribution, we found that in 2010 and 2009, between those 2 years, 93% of all new income went to the top 1%, and the bottom 99% of our people shared the remaining 7%. So when you talk about deficit reduction, and this is the point that I think Don was trying to make, we should understand that we are losing every single year about $100 billion in taxes because corporations and wealthy individuals are stashing, we don't know, but unbelievable sums of money. All over the world, the number is trillions of dollars, in tax havens like the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, Panama, etc. So before we go about cutting Social Security and cutting Medicare and cutting Medicaid and cutting food stamps and cutting programs that the most vulnerable people in this country desperately depend upon, maybe, just maybe, we want to end these tax havens that enable people with incredible wealth to avoid paying taxes. I think that's Don's point, and I certainly agree with him. But bottom line here is a nation. You cannot, it is just immoral and it's bad economics to balance the budget on the backs of the people who are already hurting, people who are already suffering as a result of this recession, while the people on top who are doing phenomenally well laugh all the way to the bank.
Mary in Riverside, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you very much. I'd like to know when the new Obamacare goes into effect as far as low-income people becoming eligible for Medicaid, if they have an IRA account of any substance, does that disqualify them from eligibility if they're otherwise eligible?
No, I don't have the papers in front of me, but I think not. The goal of one of the important components of the Affordable Care Act is that it will extend Medicaid to some 30 million more Americans, and many of those folks will be low-income working people who today have no health insurance at all.
Emma, in Sacramento, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Hello, how are you?
Hi. I'm sorry. I haven't talked to anyone on the phone this way in 30 years, but I've been going nuts about this. I don't understand why there's so much reluctance to raise, to take the cap off of Social Security payments from the worker. When you get over $110,000 a year, which is going to be this year, is going up again from 106, you're not starving. You could pay a little bit more. I think that if every person who makes over $110,000 a year has to pay, just like SDI, until as long to the end of their wages, that little bit every month and that little bit every year to them in proportion to what they're making would go a long way to back up a SSI, Social Security, for people who were very, like myself, who started out with very, very low wages when we started working, and we're not in community property states. So we have virtually nothing. I mean, I've been working since I was 7, and I get $5,500 a month.
All right, let me just pick up on that to tell you I agree with you, and that's why I introduced legislation that does exactly that. And I'm glad you raised the issue because I think it's important that we focus on Social Security, that we understand that, A, Social Security hasn't contributed a nickel to the deficit, because it is funded independently by the payroll tax, and that we understand also that with modest changes, Social Security can pay out every nickel owed to every eligible American for the next 75 years. Right now, it's 21 years. So when you hear people tonight on television tell you how Social Security is going broke, understand the Social Security is a $2.7 trillion surplus, can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 21 years. But the point that the caller made is that right now, if you make $1 million or $10 million a year, you're contributing the same exact amount into the Social Security Trust Fund as if you were making $110,000 a year. What people don't know and don't remember is that 4 years ago, a candidate for president of the United States called Barack Obama proposed that, in fact, we lift that cap and then start at not $110,000, whatever the number was then, but at $250,000. And if you do that, Social Security will pay out every benefit for the next 75 years. I thought that was a great idea. And that is exactly the legislation that I've introduced, which has a number of co-sponsors. So I think that in terms of Social Security, which has been so enormously important for the people of this country, Tom, sometimes I fear that people just take Social Security for granted, don't know that before Social Security, half of the elderly people in this country lived in poverty. Today that number is 10%. Don't know that Social Security is providing disability benefits to millions of Americans, allowing them to live in dignity, protecting widows and orphans who lose the breadwinner in the family. So I think your caller has provided exactly the right solution to making sure Social Security will be softened for the next 75 years.
Amen, brother. Michael in San Diego, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Hey, Senator Sanders. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to both of you. Tom, I hope you get better, man. We need you. First
Thank
off,
you.
My question for you, Tom, is Goosellini a play on Mussolini?
Yeah, we had a crazy goose in our backyard. In fact, the caller just dropped, so I'll just leave it at that. When we lived on the river, we had a crazy goose that would try to lock us in the house. Steve in North Troy, Vermont, you're on the air with Senator Sanders, with your senator, with Bernie.
Hey, Bernie, how are you?
Good, Steve. How you doing?
Pretty good. I'm not sure if you know, but they just changed the allowable coliform levels in Vermont. on the beaches and lakes from 77 to 235. And I know you're a champion of the family farms, Bernie, and we all are. But it's the factory farms that are killing us up here, and I've seen a market decline in this. Is there any way we can get the EPA to lower that, or at least get the state of Vermont to put it back, or try and clean up these factory farms?
Well, it's funny you mention that, Steve, because I just left the company of Lisa Jackson, who is the administrator of the EPA. And during the course of the day, we had the administrator sitting down with people in the agricultural committee to go over issues just like that. So obviously in Vermont, we are virtually all of us are strong supporters of family farmers, and we're also strong supporters of the environment. So we will see what we can do to work those things out.
Okay. Jim in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Bernie. We've got a minute to the break.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, and thanks to both of you for being who you are and what you're doing. My question is regarding the gold standard that we used to have in this country that made it great. In 1971, Nixon did away with it. So can we ever get back to it again? I know the rich people don't want to do it because they got to keep getting rich.
Let's just let Bernie answer the question here. You said a few seconds.
Well, the answer is I don't know, Jim. That makes a whole lot of sense to me. So I'm not in favor of going back to the gold standard. I am very strongly in favor of the Federal Reserve playing the role that it should be playing, and that is to protect the interests of small business and working families and not just the folks on Wall Street. And the whole issue of the Fed is something we can talk, but I am not a fan of going back to the gold standard.
Okay. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. I think of him as America's senator, although the good citizens of Vermont know he's theirs. His website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with more of your questions for Bernie in our Thursday afternoon edition of Brunch with Bernie, right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
And sanders.senate.gov is Bernie's website. Ours is tomhartman.com. You can drop in there. I'm sorry I haven't been able to get into the chat room today, but I will soon.
Disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Our special Brunch with Bernie Thursday edition with Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Bernie, during our non-commercial break, we had a caller with a question. You want to paraphrase
the
question?
Yeah, the caller from Georgia, you know, basically said that her family is a low-income family. And what she worries is that if Romney becomes president, what's going to happen to Medicare? And I will tell you what will happen to Medicare. There is no debate about this. They are going to end Medicare as we currently know it, as it has always existed, and convert it into what is called a voucher program. And what that means is they're going to say to the seniors of this country, here is a check for some $8,000, I believe is the number that they're talking about. And with that check, you go out and you get the best private insurance that you can, best policy that you can. Now, the problem is, A, they're also going to repeal the Affordable Care Act and our effort to make sure that people with pre-existing conditions are not discriminated against. And B, what they're going to say is, okay, you're 67, you're 68 years of age, and you've been diagnosed with cancer or serious heart disease. Now, Tom, you tell me, and I want the listeners to think about this. If you go into an insurance company and you got a check for $8,000 and you say, oh, yes, I am dealing with cancer. I'm dealing with a serious heart disease. And, yes, this is going to cost you, the insurance company, tens of thousands of dollars to treat me. Because that's the reality of my medical condition. And here is my check for $8,000. What are you going to give me? Well, what do you think that insurance company is going to say?
They're going to show you the door.
They're going to show you the door. Why would they lose money on you a week after they took that account?
Yeah.
So then you're left with this check for $8,000. I don't know what you do. The caller asks, what happens to us? I don't know what happens to you. I think on one hand, we lose 45,000 people a year in the United States of America because they don't get health care when they need. And I'm sure that if this Romney concept, Orion concept of a voucherized Medicare plan goes into effect, we're going to start losing a heck of a lot more seniors who could and should be treated, but are simply not going to have the money to do that. So it is a cruel and disastrous idea, and these guys do know what they're doing. They're working for the insurance companies. They're working for the drug companies. They're working for the wealthiest people in this country, and they are turning their back completely on working families and lower-income people and middle-class people. And that's the reality, and that's, to a large degree, what this election is about.
Jim, in St. Joseph, Missouri, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Jim?
Hello, is it? Yeah.
Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, okay, hey, Senator Sanders. Yeah, so I had a different question, but I heard somebody call and ask about what to do with people that hide their money, like in the Cayman Islands.
Yep.
And what about passing a bill that if you do that, we can revoke your citizenship? So, you know, if you like the Cayman Islands so much, you can just live there. You know, that would, one, probably keep Mitt Romney from being eligible for president, which would be fine with me. And then, two, it would, you know, so many people that think there's too many people coming in, well, we can just start sending some people out, balance it out. So what about passing a law?
Well, those are interesting concepts, Jim. I mean, one of the things that gets me is these very, very wealthy people and these large corporations tell us how much they love the United States of America. And yet you got the heads of these large corporations who have made outsourcing into their business model. They've been very clear that in every way that they possibly can, it makes sense for them to shut down plants in the United States over a period of years, throw millions of workers out on the street to move to China, to move to Vietnam, to move to countries where workers are paid very, very low wages. That's how much they love America and how much they respect the people who made their corporations great. And the second thing, the second way that they show us how much they love this country is they will do anything and everything they can to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. And one of the ways they do it, as Jim just mentioned, is to put, and we don't know how much, we really don't know. There have been studies out there that from an international perspective, not just the United States, we're talking about trillions of dollars being hidden in these tax havens offshore. And I think clearly Jim is right. We have got to be very, very aggressive about saying to these guys who are millionaires and billionaires that I'm sorry, you're going to have to pay your fair share of taxes because we're not going to balance the budget on the elderly and the children and those people who are really, really hurting. So I think Jim's point is well taken.
Marie in El Jebel, Colorado. We're getting up to the end of the hour here, Marie. So a real short question, please.
Go questions. Bernie, I have two. First of all, one of the reasons for a high percentage of taxes on the 1% is that after a certain point, you have plenty of money to live the high life. If you're just going to have to give the money back to the government at some point, my guess is that some CEOs, some boards might go, well, we might as well pay our employees a living wage. That's one of the reasons that I don't hear this being discussed. And secondly, I'd love to hear your take on what you think the end game is. Why do the 1% want to destroy the rest of us?
Okay, Marie, you've asked two great questions.
I think that, very briefly,
from a moral perspective, I think we have got to make it clear that what Marie said is exactly correct. Look, when you're worth hundreds of millions and billions of dollars, you're going to have enough money to do anything you want. But the truth of the matter is, and you're going to have enough money to leave your kids and your grandchildren, but the truth of the matter is there really is a limit to how much a human being needs. And to say that we are not going to pay, we millionaires, we're not going to pay anything more in taxes, even if it means the kids in this country go hungry, this is a moral issue, which I would hope the American people stand up and say, no, you can't get away with that.
Bernie, thanks so much for being with us this week.
Thank you, Tom.
It is great having you on. And remember, everybody, Sanders.Senate.gov. Check it out. We'll be back tomorrow. Actually, somebody else will be back tomorrow, but I'll be back on Monday. We'll see you then. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get out there and you get an active tag. You're it. See you soon.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.